Good evening, everybody. Thank you for that very kind presentation. I must say that I've only been working on climate change for a few years. I've been involved in sustainable development, mainly as an activist, as a student, and so on, for the last decade or so. So it's a bit of a challenge to come after someone like Arthur, who really knows what he's doing. And I must say, I'm a bit like Isaac Newton said, who's not from Oxford but from Cambridge, that I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. So most of the facts I will be talking about are just snippets I picked up from different scientists I've had the pleasure to meet or hear from or read about, whereas myself, I'm not that deep as an expert. I'm more from the advocacy side. I've been asked to talk about the impacts of climate change on developing countries. This is really a depressing topic, so I will try to also be able to come to a bit on what we can do towards the end about this, but brace yourself for a rather depressing half hour. To start with, I will try to give a bit of a conceptual framework about why the developing countries, and especially poor people in developing countries, but as we saw in the case of Katrina, poor people around the world are the most vulnerable to climate change. And that is based on our concept of sensibility, how strong they can adapt to climate change, and how vulnerable they are to climate change. So we'll start with sensitivity. That is trying to measure the biophysical effects of climate change and what this means for us as humans. And I just want to underline that climate change, as we already heard from Arthur, will have tremendous negative impacts for all of the biosphere. So lots of species will be threatened, but I will focus on humans, the impact on mankind at this stage. So climate change will have a big negative impact on, for example, crop yields and on energy demand. Sensitivity deals with the impact and in which context it has. And then if you look at different societies, they might be differently sensitive. For example, if you look at banking sector, I mean, the banking sector isn't as such so sensitive. But the companies that they, for example, lend money to might be very sensitive to climate change. Typical example would be agriculture. Especially if you look at agriculture that is dependent on that it rains at the right time, is very sensitive to changes in climate, changes in when the monsoon is coming, if the monsoon is coming, if it's coming all at once or not, compared to, you know, buildings. So in that sense, above the whole issue of how sensitive we are because we in the West have much more money, or in the North maybe I should say, there's also the difference in how economic systems are built up. As we heard before, there has been a big increase in climate-related catastrophes. This is mainly weather catastrophes, so such as droughts, as severe storms. And 73% with them were climate-related. This is a great increase. We can see that, for example, in just one example, in Mozambique, as you might remember, there was a very heavy cyclone and rains that caused flooding that knocked off 3/4 of their growth. And if you're looking at, for example, Africa, 1/4 of its population lives within 100 kilometers of the coast, and a number of people at risk for coastal flooding is rising severely. And this is just one example. Whereas we in the north are sensitive to climate change, we then often take out insurance. So while the tremendous increase in damages to climate change, some people put that down to, well, we just have more of these nice boats and everything, and that will, we can insure that, and then it comes back. Well, that is starting to change. including in areas in the rich developed world. Some parts of the Florida Keys, you no longer can get insurance for your house. The problem is, though, that whereas we in the north can afford to have these nice things and be stupid, as in, I would say, some people in Florida as well in California are, as in building at really the wrong place. When it comes to people like here in Kenya, nomads who have herds, their insurance is their herd. And when the herds, these you see there on the ground, is cows that have died, they have a much greater sensitivity to climate change because their insurance dies. If we then move to adaptive capacity, here's a bit of a quaint older example. In Houston, where they, more than 100 years ago, built a seawall. So the adaptive capacity depends on a lot of different measures. As you can see, most of these, the rich industrialized world is much better off than the poorer parts of the world. The problem, though, as we, with sad effects, saw in Catarina, just because you have the capacity doesn't mean you use it. If they could build this seawall more than 100 years ago, why didn't they do it then in New Orleans, despite the numerous repeated risks from the experts? You will all already a lot hear about the issue of adaptation and mitigation. Adaptation is adapting. This is the definition that this group of scientists that Arthur mentioned, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has defined, and that it differentiates between actual and expected, because of course it will be much cheaper, as with the example of the Thames seawall, if you anticipate something's going to happen and then you do something about that before things happen, compared to having London flooded and then trying to pump the water out. That's really expensive and difficult. To come back, mitigation means what we can do to change our behavior. In the context of climate change, that mainly means burning less fossil fuels, preserving our forests better. The third part on this triangle I showed in the beginning, vulnerability. And vulnerability to climate change is the risk of adverse things happening. And it's the exposure, the sensitivity, and how you can adapt. And unfortunately, developing countries are, because of the economic structure and the question of wealth and human capacity, and also where they live, are really getting the worst of climate change, despite the fact that they have not caused it, as in the human parts of that, because that's, if you're looking at where most of the CO2 that's been put out in the atmosphere, it's from the Industrial Revolution, starting here in the UK in the 1850s and onwards. When then bad things happening, like here in the flooding in, I believe this is Prague, at least we in the developed countries, we can help people. I mean, the flooding of Prague was very expensive, caused a lot of damage, but at least there is money to rebuild it, partly because of tourism, but also other reasons. But when you have flooding in Bangladesh, for example, there's no one there to come and help people. People are dependent on themselves. So therefore, when bad things happen, they have much worse effects in the developing world than in the developed. That said, it doesn't have to be like that. For example, Cuba, in the Caribbean, where lots of storms happen, have built up a relatively good system of early warning, shelters, and so on. So in the last year, when you had so many bad storms happening, almost no people in Cuba died. So it is possible, even at relatively limited means,
to adapt.
And also, when we are at the case of Cuba, there is also a, you can see on how there's other ways to adapt. If you look back in history, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, who had held Cuba under the arms for quite some time, especially in giving them cheap oil and export money, when that crashed, Soviet Union crashed, Cuba suddenly had no fossil fuel, which also is very important for the need, because natural gas is the main feedstock to create artificial fertilizer. So their agriculture had a big problem. But over the number of years, through adopting a lot of what we in the North call kind of eco-agriculture, they were able to actually surpass the previous agriculture output over a number of years. So it is possible to adapt. Listing some of the socio-economic impacts, and that is actually one of the big problems of the work of the IPCC, which they are very aware of, because the IPCC doesn't carry out its own research. It only assembles and says where the state of the research is. And because this started as a natural science issue mainly, we now have, starting to have, a pretty good grasp of the carbon cycle and so on, and getting better and better models on how this will happen. But because there's so few social scientists involved, such as myself, but also it's much more difficult to make proper models because humans don't necessarily act according to models. So what will the impact be when we have these refugee streams? When suddenly really bad things happen? Hopefully, humanity may rise up to the challenge and we might unite as a global people, or we will see, as some gloom talkers talk about, more wars about resources, more putting up walls, more people trying desperately to find a way to survive, running into areas where there are already people under stress trying to survive, and the conflicts that come from that. So it could go both ways. We don't know. Hopefully, we will go towards the vision that Arthur was talking about. And in this sense, there's a very nice Chinese proverb: where there is a will, there is a way. As I've already mentioned, climate change is mainly affecting poor people. Obviously, the disasters we mentioned before, it's true, most of the economic cost hit the north, partly because we have insurance systems, and also we have more expensive things to damage, like these boats we saw before. But the people who die are mainly, unfortunately, in the developing countries. You might not have heard it because it hardly made the news, but more than 1,000 people have died in Ethiopia over the last couple of weeks because of flooding. Because previously they've had such bad drought that once the rains actually come, the ground can't actually take up the water. We also heard the figures on the economic cost of the damage of Katrina, which depends on where you read, $150, $200 billion. That's just from one catastrophe or one season of catastrophe in one country. So up to half of ODA, means overseas development aid, which is the money that the rich countries give, donate to the poor countries, up to half of that is at risk from climate change. Because Bangladesh is one of the worst examples, because it is such a low-lying country with so many people, it is maybe one of the worst-off countries, but still. As you might know, the UN put up this lofty goal of halving poverty and many other sub-goals, the Millennium Development Goals. many of these, despite the fact that there is not one single Millennium Development Goal linked to energy. Guess why? Are affected by that. For example, we can see increases in cholera, starvation, flooding, cyclones, and what impact these have on our chances to eradicate poverty. As Arthur mentioned, the IPCC, this science board, put out a report, and this is from one of the science authors, a lead author of one of the chapters, who put together this. And the last time this report came out, in 2001, next year, the next report will come out. And I had the opportunity to meet some of these scientists and be at a scientific symposium in Beijing to hear some of what is being reported and will come in here. So this slide would probably be much worse if in 1 year time, but this is then last year's thing. And what it's trying to show here is on the bottom there you have the increase in global mean, so the average temperature, and on the other side, how many people are at risk for this. So we look at coastal flooding, and this is only then till I think 2080, if I remember correctly. So not continuous, because a lot of the flooding of the melt, because of the melting, is over centuries of time, even though a lot of these figures are changing now, because it's melting much faster than they previously thought, so it's a bit in flux now. But you see, hundreds, or maybe 17 million people are at risk for flooding. Roughly the same for hunger. Risk of malaria, because when it gets warmer and so on, the malaria flies and the parasite can survive in different areas, therefore increasing the amounts of people at risk. But the really scary part is the risk of water shortage. And here it's not millions anymore, here it's billions. So up to 3.5 billion people would be at risk for warming of 2.5, 3 degrees above what we saw in pre-industrial times. And this is somewhat older graph from, showing where the areas where people are at risk for drought. And as you can see, a lot of it is in the developing world. Northern Africa, India, China, the Middle East. Just looking at one of the worst examples of where this will happen, one of these models, and I want to highlight here that whereas temperature models are somewhat good, models forecasting precipitation and change in precipitation are a bit weaker, so don't take these for sure, but they're the best we have at the moment. That shows for a global mean warming of 1.8 to 2.6 degrees, which unfortunately starts to look like it's the lower range of what warming we will have, you will see a decrease up to 40% precipitation in North Africa compared to what we had in 1960 to 1990s. And this is in an area where you already have a very big shortage of water. And what will this happen for people who can no longer support themselves? And this, we also then need to remember, in combination with increased sea level rise. Because one of the problems with sea level rise is not just that you actually drown, it's also that the water comes up, and therefore you have salt water coming into the sweet water or the fresh water aquifers, therefore making the water unusable. So it's not just that. Agriculture is maybe the other biggest problem with climate change in the developing world. And I focused here on India, because they are one of the developing countries that have the best statistics for this. The map you see here, unless it's readable in fact, shows which districts already have degraded soil and poor or shallow soil cover. And as you can see, roughly a third of India's GDP comes from agriculture, but 70% of its population are either directly or indirectly dependent on its agriculture output. In another of these forecasts, if you have a 2.5 to 4.9 increase, which is what the scientists say within by 2100, this could, with a 20% drop in precipitation, this could decrease the rice output between 15 to 40%, whereas the wheat could decrease between 25 to 55%. We have over 1 billion people living in India. 70% of them dependent on the agriculture, and we're looking at maybe a decrease of half in agriculture output. And this is not only in poor developing countries. Already now, last year, Australia had a very severe drought. Australia is already the driest continent. And they had a decrease in their agricultural output of 30%. They had, for the first time since independent from the UK, they had to import food. The question is, what happens when you have problems like this in many different regions? There's not that much surplus agricultural production. And then, if the price goes up, who will not be able to pay? So an increase in temperature could reduce farm net revenues. This is, of course, money, but money is then also for buying food, even if you can't then grow it anymore in your own area. If we then look at sea level rise, for 1 meter, and this was much better in Arthur's graph, you could displace millions of people at a huge cost, and also with a big infrastructure cost. A lot of bridges, roads would be washed away or would be severely damaged. And as you know, most people live relatively close to the coast. If you look at the map, where are the biggest cities in the world? Many of them are close to the ocean. Roughly 20% of the CO2 that is emitted, man-made emission of CO2, comes from what in UN lingo is called LULUCF, land use change and forestry. So that means cutting down trees, changes going from having forest areas to non-forest areas. What you see here is a palm oil plantation in, I think it's Malaysia. And what you can't that much see in the back is a big cloud. As you know, for several years, there's been big fires because people have been clearing what they see as unproductive forest in order to put these plantations. And the real irony of it is, and this is something that hopefully our politicians will get right, but I wouldn't count on it, is a big boom for this palm oil plantations is a new legislation in the EU which says that 5.2% of all our vehicle fuels should be biofuels by 2010. And the thing is, palm oil is much cheaper than growing grapes in France or barley or something and converting that into ethanol in Europe. So right now, a lot of the biofuels that we then use and feel very good about, if we're not careful in making sure that they are certified, not in that they're produced in a sustainable way, they might actually make the situation even worse by causing deforestation. This is a bit of a sidetrack, but I want to highlight that ethanol from Brazil is not as bad, because that's sugarcane, which is produced in a different way and is not, at least now, causing deforestation, whereas soy production to make biodiesel, and particularly the production of palm oil for biodiesel in Indonesia and Malaysia, is a huge problem. And it's not only a problem for the climate, it's also a problem of people's air. This is a picture from 97 from NASA showing how big the smog cloud came from the slash and burning. And most of these fires were started by people who wanted to expand their land. And also because of the increased temperature, land is much drier, it burns much easier, which we have seen also in Spain and Portugal have had the worst forest fires almost ever. This might not be a big problem for a lot of people, but some of the maybe most beautiful areas in the world, some of these paradise islands, they're not just threatened, they're actually existentially threatened. These nations might no longer exist because of sea level rise. This is in Tuvalu. This is also in Tuvalu, where a wave, because you don't necessarily have to have sea level rise covering the island totally. It's enough that we have increase in sea level, and then when you have bad storms, the island is actually washed over. And then you have penetration of salt water into the very limited amounts of fresh water they have, making agriculture impossible, making it very expensive to maintain life there. So you already have, I think it's not Tuvalu, but Nauru, that has made an agreement with Australia that once they have to leave, they are now allowed, 20 or so thousand inhabitants, to move. So a whole nation will cease to exist once climate change happens bad enough. And it's more or less inevitable. So a whole nation will become a diaspora. As in many other issues, Africa is going to be the worst hit by climate change. Most of this is other areas which we see in development in general, that it's the poorest country, most technology backwards, more or less sidestepped by this boom in globalization that is starting now to develop China, for example. We're seeing lots of drought, flooding, diseases, civil conflict, and poor governance. Just as an idea here, I mean, this is a night picture from NASA, and as you see, there's lots of energy in, well, especially in Europe, almost none in Africa. 85% of the energy used for heating and cooking in Malawi is coming from dung and from traditional wood sources. 52% of sub-Saharan Africa lives in absolute poverty, meaning on less than $1 a day. And very big importance on agriculture, both for livelihood as well as for export earning. And we will see more of droughts in Horn of Africa, especially as well as the rest of it. The impacts of sea level rise in Africa, just one example, in the Nile Delta. Just half a meter would affect 4 million people and flood the city of Alexandria. You saw this slide earlier, which shows the CO2 emissions from industrial processes. And as you can see, South America and Africa contributed very little, whereas Asia is coming up. But I want to say that focusing too much on just the big countries to some extent blurs the issue, because their emissions per capita are actually very low. But it is clear that if we want to have a functionable climate regime that is able to deal with this issue, we need to address the emission from these big developing countries because of that they make up such a big part of humanity. So China is forecasted to overtake US in 20 years' time. And this caused a tremendous equity problem, which Arthur mentioned before as well, that these countries still are working to claw their way up the developing ladder to actually be able to give their citizens what we take for granted. So to ask them to avoid developing is a non-option. But what we need to do is to come to some kind of solution of decoupling development from CO2-intensive energy use. And that's the challenge. Big problems of this is how we can create this. Politicians, especially in developing, in democratic countries, are inherently short-sighted. They want to get re-elected. And it's of course, very great when you, as in the UK, start having a fight between David Cameron and Tony Blair of who can be the greenest. But the problem is that they're all kind of in the long run, 2050, when they're all kind of gone. But when you get them to actually, in, for example, the European Emission Trading Union, Emission Trading System, ask them to put very strict caps on their own industries, then it's a very different issue. And then we see, when the figures came out in May, that I think 17 out of the 25 EU countries had over-allocated. And which meant that you had to pay more money for it. There is often a big focus on China. And as we heard, China is building 60 gigawatt of power generation capacity every year. That's almost as much as UK has. And almost all of China's energy comes from burning of their own coal, which is, unfortunately, of a very low quality as well. They're currently using 40% of the world's coal, which is more than most of us. And the thing is, China is very concerned about being dependent. As you might have seen, China is being very active in going to Africa, making deals, dealing with, for example, the regime in Khartoum, in order to ensure that they will be able to have access to oil there. Because they are very concerned about any movement towards limiting their growth that they see now. To come to the issue on how we can get a climate regime that can solve this issue, we then have to focus on the world's biggest emitter. If the US does not engage, it would be impossible to ask developing countries such as China and India and Brazil and others to do something. Because if you look at the per capita emissions, the US is the worst. Well, no, there's a few small countries in the very much oil, like Kuwait, which is even worse. But that's about it. Whereas if you look at the per capita average, it's very low. And both China, Brazil, and India are below the world average. And it's only because China is such a huge chunk that they make up the second largest emitter. I just want to go back a bit on what kind of demands will we need to have on a climate regime. Haldo will tomorrow talk much more about this, and he's knowledgeable on this as well. But I still want to, and this is maybe a bit of my NGO background that comes in, point out where we need to go United Nations Convention on Climate Change, this paper that was signed in 92, which is has lofty goal of reducing climate change, so to avoid dangerous interference to the climate system. The thing is, there is no definition of what is dangerous interference. People are starting to try to define this, and my impression from speaking to people, as well as actually it's the goal of the European Union, is to no more than 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. But that is global average. But that means when we put it in, because it will be higher in the Nordic spheres and higher over countries. That makes a difference. So we can see that 2 degrees would lead to tens of millions of people who would be at risk of hunger. Hundreds of millions would be in risk of malaria and other diseases. And not to talk about the billions who would be at risk of water shortage. And this is, as I've underlined through the presentation, poor people and poor countries are the worst hit. Sea level rise. I had the opportunity to speak to one of the leading scientists, Thomas Ramsdorf, at Potsdam Climate Impact Research. And there's a big uncertainty because their old models no longer work. The melting is so much faster than they thought before. Big explanation, they think, is because the melting is now coming down to the ground, so the water is working as a lubricant, letting glaciers glide hundreds of meters where they previously moved a meter a year. So there's a big acceleration, and they don't really know exactly how fast this will happen. This 2-degree warming would mean severe threats to major ecosystems, from the Arctic to the Antarctic and everything in between. There was a question about forests previously. In one of the models, it even shows that the whole of the Amazon might disappear as we know it, as a rainforest, and turn into some kind of savanna. If that would happen, all bets are off, because all the climate models we have build on Amazon being a big stabilizer and uptaker of carbon. Avoiding 2-degree warming is going to be difficult, but it is not impossible. Mahatma Gandhi, in another context, said something I think is very interesting. And it goes back to what we talked about, that if we approach this hard-nosed, economically short-sighted, only thinking about ourselves and our own nations, we're going to have a huge problem. But if we look broader, and I think actually people in most of the world would be more willing to do this, I think there's a big untapped potential for political leadership here. I mean, just take the example of the Apollo project, putting a man on the moon. That captured everybody's imagination. It gave us this picture. No one asked about how much did that cost. I mean, it was in the context of the Cold War competition. But there's nothing that says we can't have new Apollo projects in the future. Also, it was mentioned the issue on happiness. There is studies that look at this. And actually, the happiest people in the world are people in Nigeria. Whereas in my own part of Sweden where I come from, now the biggest sector of medicines sold are antidepressants. So if we can get more of this thinking in, and I think there is a great untapped will to move beyond just consumption and egoism, but there needs to be leadership, and I think the spiritual community has a big role to play there. So how could roughly the borderlines for a climate regime be? 2 degrees, I think, is what we need to do. Warming beyond that, I mean, 2 degrees will still be very nasty, but going below 2 degrees is by now more or less impossible. This means a reduction of 70% of greenhouse gases globally by 2050. It needs to be fair, and it needs to be effective. It needs global participation through natural targets consistent with a global limit. But I want to underline here, it needs to be fair. We were able to build our wealth using fossil fuels. This option is no longer available for developing countries. We need really to make it easy for them to keep develop, but just not the way we did it. Just as an estimate of the amount of money involved, according to the National Energy Agency's forecast, $17 trillion, not billion, $17 trillion will be needed in investments to maintain and expand energy infrastructure in the world. 8 of these trillions need to be in the developed countries. If we just go business as usual, building these coal power plants that China, India, US are projecting, we are more or less shooting ourselves in the foot, unless we then tear these coal plants down, which hardly ever will happen, we're not going to make it. But the thing is, the International Energy Agency also made an alternative projection. I would argue it's rather flawed, but still. And that shows that it wouldn't be that much more expensive to get the development into low-carbon solutions, low-carbon technologies. As the Carbon Disclosure Project is doing, and I think what is very good, we're starting to see it, is that we need to move climate change out of just being an issue for scientists and for ministries of environment. Currently, it is the ministries of environment who go to the meetings of the UN Convention on Climate Change and negotiate. What we need to is we need to get finance ministers, prime ministers, presidents to take this issue really seriously and negotiate this. And this is slowly starting to happen. Just today, flying here in the Financial Times, first page here, car buyers switch to hybrids as fuel costs rise. China to pioneer first sustainable city, building a greener house. Slowly starting to happen. And not all of it will be for climate change. It doesn't necessarily have to be. But China, for example, they already are putting in place a stricter fuel efficiency for cars than the US has. They have a very progressive renewable energy law that will build more renewable energy than UK ever seen. They've set themselves a target to put up energy efficiency by 20% by, I think, 2010. To meet that, there is potential to solve this if we just get the leadership there to do it. It is clear we need both mitigation and adaptation on an unprecedented level. But it's clear the Kyoto Protocol has its problems. But it was never meant to be the final solution. The Kyoto Protocol was just the first step. And we have to build on this and scale it up, get the US on board, and eventually also the developing countries on board. We only have 10, 15 years to change and to create a working climate regime, to break the current emission growth if we are going to do this. If we look at some of the other regimes that have been built up, they took much longer time. We don't have that.